Could you tell me to begin with a little bit about growing up, when, where, parents, siblings,
Yeah,
that kind of
sure.
thing?
Okay, so I moved around quite a lot because my dad's a Methodist minister. So I was born in Rotherham, lived in Leicester, Sheffield, Norfolk. So all my secondary education was in Norfolk. And one brother, 2 years older than me, went to a rather weird school, which was a co-educational state boarding school.
Oh,
So it was
okay.
a day and boarding
Different.
school, but it was called Wyndham College, and I was a day pupil for the first kind of 5 years, and my dad moved again, so I boarded for sixth form. And then went to university in Cambridge,
Okay.
theology.
Surprisingly. So, do you mind me asking how old you are? Did I miss that at the start?
Yeah, I'm going to be 50 in January.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're looking good on that.
Thank you.
So you had one older brother.
Yeah.
Father was a Methodist
Yeah, mum was
minister.
a teacher, primary school teacher.
Okay, what did she teach? Just so
Just
general. Yeah,
just
yeah,
kiddie winks.
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Church, you went to a Methodist church.
Yeah.
I don't
Well, I
expect you had a
was
lot of choice in
no.
that.
No, I was pretty much forced to go to church.
Okay.
But I kind of went with the territory, really.
Okay. And
Yeah.
would you say you believed in what you were taught at church?
Yeah, I think when I was about 14, well, no, a bit earlier than that, 12, 13, I had a kind of a religious experience, really, which was a bit like the Wesleyan heart strangely warmed. And then I suppose I transferred from being just kind of it being what I was taught, it being kind of real for me.
Okay.
And that kind of fueled an interest in, religion, theology. I did RE O level and then A level. I had a teacher who I fell in love with, who I absolutely adored. And she was just great. I mean, so for 4 years, she arrived at my school when I was just about to go into my O level year. So she taught me for O level and A level.
Okay.
And I did, so then I sort of explored, because at that point I was looking for something a bit more interesting, kind of church-wise. So I explored a sort of evangelical church in Norwich that had, it's the usual thing really, had more people, more young
Yeah.
people. But I went to, after about a couple of meetings, I just thought, it's weird. There was a kind of prayer meeting that I went to, and it's that style of sitting around in groups and saying, talking to God like God's a sort of bezzy mate. God, we do just ask this, and we do just ask that, and we do just ask the other.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, I'm not sure about this. I went because there was some famous person doing the rounds at the time. I can't remember his name, a writer that. And I was just reading quite a lot. So I used to go to the SPCK secondhand bookshop in Norwich and just see what there was and just read stuff because I was just really interested. But I went to that church and thought, nah, this isn't for me. It just felt, I think I could feel the kind of authoritarianism and the rigidity
Okay.
even then. And my teacher, who was sort of becoming a friend, she's only 8 years older than me, it's her first teaching job. When I became a boarder, I got much closer to her and I used to go on Sundays to.
Okay.
She had a best friend in Norwich who went to that church, so.
Yeah.
And she became ill with a kind of unidentified illness, and the theology that came through then was, if your faith isn't strong enough, you're not getting better because your faith isn't strong enough. And at that point I thought, fuck this.
Yeah.
This is
So
not,
this was sixth
this is not,
form,
yeah,
yeah, because you
that
were a
was sixth
boarder
form.
then. So you've mentioned that you had a pash on your teacher who was female. When were you aware of having a sexual identity and
Yeah, well then I didn't have boyfriends at school really. I had one because it was almost kind of compulsory, it's just the thing, especially in the sixth form, you just sort of
Yeah.
That's what you did.
Write poetry and have a boyfriend.
Well, it's just that, I mean, you reach the point where you're supposed to walk around the school campus holding hands with a member of the opposite sex, you know, and that's kind of what you do. So this boy asked me out. I didn't realise he'd asked me out. It was a school disco, and he said so. I thought he said, "Do you want to go outside?" So I said, "Yeah." And then I suddenly realised I'd been asked out, and I said yes, which meant for a while I had to walk around school holding his hand. I had nothing in common with him. I didn't even know who he was till that point. He was in my boarding house, but so I accidentally went out with him, and then he chucked me after about 2 months anyway. So that was quite a relief. Mm. There were other boys that I actually liked. There was one other boy that I actually liked, but he didn't like me. So I kind of felt that I'd had there are other women teachers that I'd had crushes on, and I was very aware that was like kind of probably not normal. I didn't really tell anybody about it.
Yeah.
But it was incredibly. I mean, it was incredibly strong what I felt for her, and so I suppose it occurred to me that I might be a lesbian, but I didn't want to kind of go there in my head.
Okay.
And when I went to university, I just decided that I should try out the boyfriend thing. So I started going out with someone in my year in the November after starting.
This was Cambridge?
Yeah, Selwyn College.
Selwyn College.
So like 100 people in each year.
And you're doing theology?
Yeah, there were 6 of us doing theology. Okay. Quite unusual. But this guy was doing engineering. He was the kind of best looking guy in the year, looked like Tom Cruise, you know. We got together and stayed together the whole time I was at university. I went out with him. So I suppose at that point I'd put the lesbian thing away, I suppose. Then I got close to, I went on a youth exchange after my first year, which was to a Methodist scheme they had, which was to, I'd got quite involved in international social justice stuff in Methodist Church and other youth stuff, so I had kind of a leadership, national almost leadership role in that. And I went on this youth exchange to Burma and North Sumatra for 7 weeks. And the guy who organised those, a guy called Neil Whitehouse, came out as gay at around that time. Mm-hmm. So I was very friendly with him, and I felt like I had to kind of just learn a lot quickly to kind of find out, because, you know, that was like 1986. He subsequently became a bit of a Methodist called Celebra, because he candidated for the Methodist ministry and was rejected, and he went to live in Canada. He's in Canada now. So that started me thinking about sexuality a lot more. When I left, I went to live in Birmingham with friends and worked for the student Christian movement, putting together written resources. And the first thing virtually that I had to do was to coordinate a group of students, half a dozen students who wanted to work on a theological resource book that would help people think through why we thought Clause 28 was a bad idea.
Yeah.
So that was called Just Love, and I worked with, they were all, I think, lesbian, gay or bisexual.
Yeah.
And through that whole process of all the reading I had to do for that, all the conversations I had with those people, I remember thinking to myself, right, next time I have feelings for a woman, I'm going to go with it.
Okay.
So there was a student, she wasn't involved in that, but she was involved in SCM. And I got together with her. I was with her for about 18 months. So, so that was the sort of transition into coming out.
And did you identify as lesbian from that point on?
Yeah.
So you didn't think you were bisexual at any stage? Or?
Not at that point. I just identified as lesbian. And then I met a woman called Leigh Willis, who's also been part of this project. She was 14 years older than me.
Yeah.
We worked together on a document with LGCM and Stonewall,
yeah.
Which was a response to something called the Osborne Report, which was a suppressed, slightly liberal report on sexuality that, again, was around 1990, I think. Okay. 1989, 1990. Mm. So she from Stonewall, she was one of the original 20 Stonewall people.
Yeah.
She from Stonewall and me from LGCM worked on something called a call to action. And I kind of fell in love with her in the process of that. And was with her for 11, 12 years.
Wow.
So then it was pretty much my identity, really. I mean, I identify that gender is not really the determining factor. I don't call myself bisexual because I just don't like the terminology. It implies there's only two kinds of sexuality. So I have my own term, which is GND, gender non-determining.
I don't like bisexual because it implies that it's all sexual.
Yeah.
And it's not most of the time. No, but okay, so LGCM, at this point, when did you become involved with LGCM?
Well, then really, I became involved when I was working on the SCM.
Richard,
that came out in 89. We worked on it 88, 89.
Yeah.
When the booklet came out, I was in touch with Richard a lot, Richard Kirker, because, well, he just had, I mean, SCM was a friendly student organisation to LGCM, so he was in touch with us on and off, and he helped us market that, and I got, I don't think I was ever on the LGCM committee, but because the SCM job was 2 or 3 years. So at that point, Richard was in the process of setting up the ISCS, Institute for the Study of Christianity and Sexuality. And I remember writing to him and saying, when I leave SCM, I want to come and work for that organisation.
Yeah.
And he and I were both quite excited by that prospect. And so I moved, there was no money. So I moved to London and thought I'd give it a year to see whether we could raise the money.
Yeah.
And then in those days you could sign on if you had no work. And it was a thing called the Young Enterprise Project or something, where they gave you a grand up front to set up a business and then like 35 quid a week.
Okay.
So I spent the grand on a year's tube travel ticket. And then I think my rent must have been paid for, and I had this 35 quid a week to live on. And I had the best year. It was great because I was doing a lot of stuff with Richard. I was trying to get the ISCS going. We were working on getting funding. I did lots of media work through, because Richard kind of got me into all of that. I was on the Methodist Sexuality Commission from 88 to 90, so there was stuff connected with that. And I was just kind of, you know, I was passionate about the theme. I was developing my writing. I was doing a lot of workshops. And then during that year, we got money from Christian Action to employ me for 3 years.
Okay.
So that was kind of the next 3 years of my life, really. And it was great, apart from... Yeah, so we had... I mean, the point of the Institute was to say, we're not going to make any progress on lesbian and gay liberation in the church until we shift the focus onto everybody else. Everybody else has got the problem. So it was about looking at at sexuality across the board and trying to get, I mean, it's ecumenical, obviously, so trying to get Christian people to look at themes which are common to everybody. So we had conferences on aging and sexuality, on intimacy, on fidelity, on masculinity, heterosexuality, monogamy. Yeah. We had loads of pornography. You know, we'd had about 3 conferences a year, and I edited the newsletter, and we set up, with Liz Stewart, I set up the journal, Theology and Sexuality Journal, because the newsletter was too limited. It wasn't, it just kind of felt we need a forum for the thinking people are doing. So yeah, it was a really good 3 years. Apart from inbuilt in the relationship with LGCM and ISCS was this fatal kind of organisational fuck up, which meant that for some reason LGCM couldn't get charitable status at the time. So they set up ISCS to be the charitable arm.
Okay.
But they also made the remit a lot wider. So inevitably there came a conflict where if I was raising money for ISCS, Richard was wanting to keep it all for LGCM.
Okay.
And I was saying, no, this is a different organisation.
Yeah.
And anyway, it all kind of went horribly wrong, really. But and there was a lot of bad feeling. And, you know, my relationship with Richard was kind of destroyed somewhere along the line. more or less. I mean, I think I went to his 50th birthday party with Elaine, because Elaine had known him from 10, 15 years before. So, yeah, I mean, apart from that, I think we did a lot of really good work.
Okay.
And it was really important. And but at the end of the 3 years, I think there was enough money for a bit to employ me for a bit longer part-time. Mm-hmm. But I did a gender studies, women's gender studies MA.
Okay. Where was that?
Where? Mm. Warwick. Because okay. I lived in Coventry at the time. Mm. So I did that just after my... Because I did the book Found Wanting on women's experience of sexuality because of ISCS.
Okay,
because,
I was wondering where that fits.
Yeah, because it soon became clear that LGCM was not really focused on women's issues at all. I mean, that's okay. Old story. I'm sure you explored that.
Well, could you elucidate a little bit more, because we might not have it on tape from anyone.
Okay. Well, I think normatively it was a white Anglican male gay organisation. That was its history. Mm. It had expanded to become lesbian and gay. Because of that, I think a lot of women felt marginalised within it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Elaine was on the committee, I can't remember how many years before me, but she left for that reason. There was a sort of repeating history of women getting involved and then leaving. There was a women's caucus that fell out.
This
with the main organisation, Willis.
Willis, okay.
Yeah. There was a women's caucus that, again, at some point in the mid-90s, diverged and set up a separate organisation. Mm-hmm. It was the old thing about, you know, LGCM is LGCM. If you have a special interest, if you're a Methodist, Catholic, an evangelical, a woman, you have to pay twice, because you have to pay to be a member of your caucus and pay to be a member of the organisation. And inevitably people said, well, that's not really fair. But Richard was insistent. So, you know, the caucuses kind of came and went.
Mm.
And the women's caucus split off. It became Ruth's Night Out for a bit, and now there's Left.
Yeah.
So.
Are you involved with Left?
I am. Have been in the last 3 or 4 years, because I co-led a with Janice Price, who's one of the main.
Yeah.
Collective. I co-led a weekend with her, and I go to their annual things, and we just had a 20th anniversary of my book conference in Birmingham, beginning of November.
Yeah.
Which was great, actually, really good.
I wanted to come to that, but it clashed.
It clashed with a lot of things.
It clashed with a family event that I could not get.
I think there was about 5 different conferences on the 7th of November.
Well, we had an LGCM board meeting
as well.
That's
right, that was in the morning at the same venue. Yeah, they had it in the same place.
Yeah, so, and I can't go to the LGCM carol service because it's my mum's 70th on
Saturday.
Not December, November, December, bad months. No, I am going to the Left meeting in January, so
okay. I'll be going to the one in April. I can't go to the one in January because it clashes with something I've got here.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I've kind of got drawn back a bit into that, really, through Janice.
Yeah.
So what was that? I was talking about how Found Wanting fitted in, wasn't I?
Yeah.
So it felt like there was a lot of women's experience out there, and it wasn't just lesbian experience either, because we did some, I think, pretty pioneering work on sexual abuse as well.
Mm.
Because I just ended up with so many women that I found out, including just about everyone closest to me, survivors, and thinking the church does nothing, and the church had no child protection policies in place at that point at all. So with a woman called Ros Hunt, who's a priest in Cambridge, who's also a social worker, and was a bit, she was kind of, and still is, the expert on survivor issues in the church. She and I got theologians over from the States to speak. We went to the States to a woman called Marie Fortune and met with her and talked about kind of things we should do here around that issue as well. So there was a whole cluster of issues and a whole load of stories that I felt needed to be out there and needed to be told. And it was also the point that Liz Stewart's prayer book was banned.
Yeah, I interviewed Liz.
Okay.
I'm doing a doctorate at Winchester and she's deputy vice chancellor, so okay. I heard all about that. I mean, I knew vaguely about it, but hearing it firsthand from her was fascinating.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I was, she'll remember it a lot better than I will, obviously, but because of that, Richard was kind of organising a boycott of SPCK, and I happened to be in the office when he was meeting with a guy called Steve Cook from Castle, because he was saying, if people don't want to publish with SPCK, I need to set up,
Castle published your book.
And they were just setting up this, I can't remember what it's called now, but it wasn't queer then. I think it was gender studies. Anyway, it was a secular gender politics list. And they signed me up to write on women's critique of Christian sexual ethics, integrating women's experience, and that's where Found Wanting came from.
Okay.
So all those things were kind of happening simultaneously.
Yeah. Really. Was this mid-90s?
Yeah, the book came out in 95.
95, isn't it? Yeah.
I had finished working with ISCS then. I think I worked with ISCS from 90 to 94. We launched Theology and Sexuality in 94. Found Wanting came out just when I just started my course.
Yeah.
I was doing it part-time. It was so funny. It's like I said at the conference, I just used to wander into Waterstones and look at the feminist stuff, women's studies shelves, and pick, a bit like I used to do with theology in my dad's study, you know, I'd see which looked like the most attractive books and read them. It was only when I did a sort of course that made me see which strands I'd been reading and which strands I'd missed out. And the whole thing about feminist methodology, and, you know, my methodology essay I did on the use of experience in, you know, and I thought, I didn't theorise any of this before I wrote the book. I'm quite glad I didn't, because I'd probably never have written it. But it was funny sort of having a book come out and then studying what I should have studied before I wrote it. But anyway.
Yeah. What else have you published? I know you've published a number of books.
I wrote a book on wellbeing in 2002. Yeah. And then the last one I did was on identity. That's 2009. Which included stuff about sexuality, but and faith identity, but it was meant to be. It was, I suppose you'd say it's about intersectionality, really. Although I don't think that word was around in 2009. Probably even just, I hadn't come across it anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay. So tell me what's happened since. Published Found Wanting 95, done a few more publications. What's your role in the diocese here, and what other strings do you have in your bow?
Well, what happened really, when I finished, I was doing Women's Studies MA, I was planning another book, I was planning a book on power differences between women in lesbian relationships with Castle. I had a contract and everything. But I didn't have any money coming in once the part-time thing with ISCS had finished. I worked for a bit with friends in Manchester who had a sort of a freelance publications consultancy. They were all doing stuff with SCM. It's called Graft Publications. So I was doing stuff with them, which earned me little bits and pieces. But that in about 96, I just had to get a job.
Yeah.
96, 97. So also I had to decide whether I wanted to carry on just focusing on gender and sexuality, which I'd done for a while. And I remember having a conversation with someone who's very wise, who said, I don't think you should do that, because you'll be in that box and that will be your career. So I made a conscious decision to expand again and back into just social justice in general and not just focus on sexuality. So in a way I put the sexuality stuff to one side in terms of what I was doing for a job, And the first job that came up was just after the 1997 general election, and it was running Christian Socialist Movement. So I applied for that and got it. Hated it.
In what way?
Well, it was in London. Chris Bryant, who's now an MP, was the chair, and he was very good, but it was very different from what I was used to, because it was party politics, and I had no desire to be in party politics.
Okay.
And the job was to run the organisation, but it was to run the organisation for people who were in party politics, and most of the previous guy also subsequently became a Labour MP, David Cairns, sadly died very young, but so it was just all reactive, all the stuff I hate, all kind of short-term, shifting goalposts all the time. You couldn't plan, you couldn't strategize. It all had to be, oh, this issue's very, we need a publication on fox hunting to launch on Boxing Day. This is no life. I can't do this. I only survived it because somebody on the committee was a guy called Graham Smith, who's a theologian at Chichester now, but he was the publications person voluntarily for CSA, and he and I plotted another journal. So he and I set up Political Theology, which is now quite big and international, really to save my sanity, so I could get people who are actually thinking about things. So I was living in Coventry, and it was in London. I was in London 3-4 days a week, and that wasn't really working.
Yeah.
So after a year, the social responsibility job came up at Worcester Diocese, and the bishop was Peter Selby, who had been a trustee of ISCS.
Okay.
And was very supportive, and was very, probably about the only unambiguously pro-gay bishop we ever had. So I got that job starting in 98. And that's the job I do here. So since 98, I've been working for the Church of England, promoting social justice in all the different. So I just have a really broad remit.
Okay.
And I love it. And I particularly, Worcester was a small diocese, and after 4 years, I got bored. I mean, I wrote Wellbeing while I was there, and they were.
Yeah.
It came out just as I was making the move to here. But I'd split up with Elaine, and the next person I got together with was a man.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually just taken over at SCM Press. He had, when I wrote the Wellbeing book for them, he didn't commission it, but that's how I got to know him. So he and I got together, married in 2005. Divorced in 2010.
Okay.
So that didn't really work.
Didn't quite.
We were together
for
10 years, but
okay.
Yeah, because we were together for 4 or 5 years before we got married.
Okay, that's quite an interesting twist.
Yeah, I suppose.
I didn't see that coming in your conversation.
Yeah, well, it goes back to the bisexual thing, doesn't it? I guess. I mean, I had. Yeah, I just think I've. There was another almost conscious decision back, because I'd got quite into being so radically feminist that I just dismissed all men on principle. And then I've always had this inbuilt hatred of fundamentalism, and there was a point I thought, actually,
yeah,
I'm just being a fundamentalist all over again, and I should. And because when I was working with Graft, the person I worked most with was a guy called Martin Davis, who was a brilliant writer, really good, and we had a fantastic working relationship. And he was just great, and he challenged me a lot on it. So you're so lesbian, you. So yeah, why do you say as a lesbian feminist? What is it? We didn't use phrases like "what does that even mean" then, but if we had, that's probably what he would have said.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, psychologically, I just thought, come on, you've got to flex out a bit.
Yeah.
So in that process, just ended up going. And Alex and I had loads in common. We'd done theology together at Cambridge at the same time. We didn't know each other, and we'd been sort of in almost. We found out with so many conferences we'd both been at, and so many we just hadn't ever kind of hooked up. So when we did, it kind of made sense.
And did you have children?
No. No, we were... I was 39 when we got married. Mm. So kind of... I mean, it wasn't too late, but in effect it was. I kind of... Sometimes I wanted children, sometimes I didn't, so... It wasn't really a very strong basis to actually have.
Yeah.
So, and I'm glad we didn't, because it would have been a nightmare. Even more of a nightmare than it actually was, splitting up.
Yeah, I mean, not that it's relevant to this, but just out of curiosity, what's your situation now? Because I'm not someone who knows everyone in circles.
No, I'm not in a coupled relationship at the moment. And I live with friends in a kind of... Well, I live with a married couple. The man I have known since 2001, he was in my sort of work circle when I worked in Worcester. He's a singer-songwriter, Nigerian born.
Mm.
And I did some, when I did work around racism in Worcester, he helped me with it. And we stayed close, and he is a small charity that I chair, that he's the artistic director for, so we have a close working relationship with another hat.
Yeah.
And he's married to an employment lawyer, and they have 3 children. 12-year-old twins.
Yeah.
And 5-year-old boy.
Yeah.
So I'm part of the family now, and I have a parental role. And so I've had the opportunity of being a parent, because I've been living with them for 5 years full time.
Well, what do they call you? What do the kids call you?
Auntie.
Auntie?
I mean, it's an Igbo household, even though Jenny's white. So
that's
Eastern Nigeria. It's very much that culture of extended family.
Yeah, yeah.
People just get adopted into your household.
Oh, I wish I had someone in my house like that.
That's like
two teenagers.
You're not the first person to say that.
And a 10-year-old.
There's a curate here who recently had 2 children. She said,
rent yourself out.
So you do childcare? And so I said, well, yeah, of course. She's going, oh God, that sounds fantastic. Yeah, so the reason I was off for 2 weeks was because sadly Ben's mum died back in July, and they were doing the burial at the end of November.
Yeah.
And they had the date for a while. So the only way, because he's the primary child carer, so I just said, well, if I take 2 weeks off, because he was needing a 2-week trip,
yeah,
at least we know all the school runs will be covered.
Yeah.
And then as it happened, Doggo was ill for the whole time. Off school, so all my plans of going for long walks every day completely scuppered. But anyway, at least I've caught up with. Well, no, the other thing I was going to do, because I'm planning, having done that day in November, it was such a good day in terms of people's contributions, and I just sort of thought I'd really love to do a 20 years on revisit in the sense of it being driven by people's reflections and experience, women's experience and reflections of on sexuality and gender, and sort of bring it together with queer theology and queer theory and stuff. So I'm kind of planning that. I've got a meeting with the publisher tomorrow morning, so fingers crossed. So I thought, oh shit, I better catch up on the queer theory I've missed in the last 20 years. I mean, I did the queer theories and cultural studies stuff when I did the MA, even though I never finished it. So I felt like, subsequent to Fan Wanting, I did back then in the late 90s, I did a certain amount of theoretical filling in of gaps. But there has been, obviously, some queer theology since.
Yeah, Patrick Chen.
Yeah, I read that book the last fortnight.
Yeah.
And there's a womanist one that's just, it's brilliant, but at least it's out there. The book I could not afford was Gerard Loughlin's book.
That's
highly academic, isn't it?
I got that from the library, but it was quite hard work, I must admit.
Because Alex, my ex-husband, commissioned that book. I mean, because he worked for OUP, CUP, SBC, got sacked by all the Christians, SCM, SBCK. So I knew that, you know, Gerard had been working on that book for a long time, and Alex was always saying, when are you going to finish that queer theory book, Gerard? So when it came out, it was on our shelves for a while, but, you know, ironically, it's no longer on my shelf. But anyway, it's a woman in Manchester who wanted to borrow Carol because she wants to see the movie. So I said, okay, you can borrow Carol if I can borrow Gerard Loughlin.
Yeah, actually, I watched that last week.
Did you?
Yeah, obviously because my namesake.
Yeah.
My best friend in New York's called Teresa, so it's quite
funny. Oh, really?
I don't transcribe the bits that aren't relevant, don't worry. It's not a verbatim transcription, it's sound bites because... Yeah. Yeah. We were never going to get there, because I was doing the verbatim transcriptions. I did Jim Cotter's.
Right.
Sharon Ferguson's was an hour and 40 minutes.
Right.
Took me absolutely forever. But yeah, no, the film, it was very true to the book, which I was glad about.
Yeah.
I did find Kate Blanchett a bit off-putting in it.
It's interesting, because somebody said, I can't imagine her in that role. I think it's Elaine, actually. Because I still see Elaine, we're still great mates. So
yeah.
She said, I can't imagine. Because I think it was Elaine's, because Elaine's middle name's Carol. So, and I think because she'd had it originally, when it first came out, and I hadn't, and I think I borrowed it from her, and I maybe didn't give it back, because it's an old hardback. I mean, it is called Carol, it's not called Taste of Salt.
Price of Salt.
Price of Salt. So anyway, so I lent that to Michaela and she's sending me Gerard, but I wasn't holding out much hope that it, just thought I'd just better look at it. I looked on Amazon, it was secondhand, £35.
Oh,
I'm not paying that.
It's like Kindle books are about the same now as well. Going back to the church, I am post-church, I have to say. I've had quite bad experiences myself in the Church of England. I can't even sit in the service now. I wonder what are the limitations imposed on your work by the Church of England? What places can you not go to metaphorically?
That's an interesting question. I was post-church, and particularly when I was with Elaine, because she'd had really traumatic experiences, and never really worked out what to do with her spirituality, really. I was sort of in that place. Once I'd done the Sexuality Commission and I sort of dropped out of Methodism and dropped into nothing, and for years I didn't go near a church. But I still had the interest, the theological interest.
Yeah.
I didn't really know what my faith identity was. I just couldn't work it out. I knew it was problematic because I used to get very, how long was this phobia? If I had to be in a worship service, I'd just get have really weird emotional reactions to things that I couldn't, so I just avoid them. So if I went on conferences and there was a worship slot, I would always miss it. And I was still going, so I was doing training, I was doing all sorts of things where there was quite often worship slots. Yeah. And I would dread the fact that I'd be kind of cornered and have to sit through something.
Yeah, I always went to the toilet when they did the toilet. Just random people hugging you.
So I kind of knew it was problematic, but I also quite got into the Sea of Faith network, which is,
I don't know.
Yeah, well, so there's Don Cupid, who is what's known as a non-realist, so his argument, and I studied under him at Cambridge, and I found his thinking really exciting. It's just that whole notion that God is a human creation, you know. It doesn't mean God has no meaning, but there's no objective God outside. And that kind of went with modern theory, and it kind of fitted with. So I was quite involved in. It's the network is called Sea of Faith because there was a TV program in the 80s. He was quite famous, Don Cupid, because of this TV program series. So when I went to Cambridge and he was the kind of first theologian I met, it's kind of, oh my God, it's Don Cupid. So I read all his books. He was my supervisor for philosophy of religion papers, and I just found it a really fascinating perspective, and I always stayed with that. So all the time I worked for SCM, my boss Tim used to make fun of me, saying, "Oh, she doesn't believe any of this stuff. She's a non-realist." But then I kind of found it a bit bankrupt after a while. I thought, "Well, you know, what about transcendence? And what about And actually, interestingly, Don Cupid got back into that towards. He's still alive. But his books kind of move much more. So I guess I move much more towards a sort of mystical kind of contemplative but not fitting any institutional workings at all. It's just my own private, personal stuff. But then, you know, I was working for the Church of England. Still holding those views and perspectives, but having to use a different language. And it was fine for a bit. But then I wanted to explore the whole thing in a book, because I feel like if I want to work out what I feel or think about something, I have to write about it. So I was going to do a whole book on faith identity and just explore, because at the end I found wanting, I have this thing about, I'm a lesbian of Christian heritage. And if somebody says, should I stay or should I go, you say, well, it's a non-question, because it's a setup, because you're responding to something that you've had no power in setting up, and you're asked to fit, to define yourself by... So it was just problematising the whole thing about what Christianity actually is before you define whether or not you are one. You know, it was just that. And I thought, I can't write this book unless I actually deal with my own stuff.
Yeah.
And for 8 years, probably, I mean, I had this plan to write about it for a year, I can't remember how many years, but certainly I worked in Worcester for 4 years. And I knew it had to be somebody who, because I tried, you know, friendly faith leaders, you know, bishop here that I was friendly with, but it just didn't work, because they're too kind of... You get to a point in the conversation and you think you're not taking this, you know, you're not getting it. So I found this guy by accident, because I was looking for an alternative career at one time. I thought, maybe I'll be a therapist. So I ended up and I wanted to live in Norfolk, so I kind of found this guy in Norwich called Brian Thorne. And when I, because he was the head of person-centred therapy at UEA, and then it transpired that he was kind of leading theological lay kind of Anglican person. So I got a hold of his books and read them, and I wrote to him and said, and sent him Wellbeing, and said, I'd quite like to meet you. So he phoned me, like, as I discovered he always does, like, on receipt of the communication. And I had lunch with him, and that was like 10 years ago. So he's been my sort of spiritual accompanist stroke therapist ever since. So that's really helped me to just disentangle the emotional stuff and the rejection stuff and what I feel like, who I feel I am, what... the fact that I love God, but I have never fitted in with, even though I've been working for the Church of England, I suppose I value my Methodist heritage. I've never been Anglican. I like the nonconformity that I was brought up with, and now I go to church sometimes with the kids, and I go to the Methodist church in Melbourne.
Yeah.
But I still find church services pretty uninspiring and not a necessary part of my life.
Yeah.
I suppose I call myself a Christian again, but with all of those provisos of what the hell does it mean anyway?
Yeah, it's becoming disreputable almost as an identity. Yeah. If you say it to people, there's assumptions about your views, which is always the problem I have.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm a lesbian feminist theologian or whatever, and with me it's I'm a left wing Guardian reading Christian. And I thought, why am I doing this? But it's all about that,
So in terms of, just going back to the question of what are the restrictions in terms of my job, I think there's one occasion in this job when I have, see, in Worcester, Bishop, Peter Selby was just, I think my first meeting was him calling together the gay clergy in the diocese, because it was straight after Lambeth Conference 98. And apologising to them and saying he'd been there, it felt like the Nuremberg rallies, he was there to support them, whatever he could do, they should let him know. And I'm kind of, whoa.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, he was amazing, and he still is amazing.
I'd be looking for the hidden cameras.
Yeah. Here, there's nothing like that. In all the time, I've been here 12 years now, I've organised one event that's had anything to do with sexuality, and that was a pastoral care event after Geoffrey John was booted out of Bishop of Reading, because that brought the whole thing back up. At that time, I wrote a couple of articles, and I didn't think twice about writing articles. I wrote one for The Guardian, reflecting on what had changed in 10 years, and it had about post-colonialism and, you know, the international scene. And then I wrote a longer version of that for Crucible, which was the sort of National Social Justice Anglican Journal. I don't know whether it still exists. And one of the bishops here talked to my boss and said, why did Alison write that? And she said, oh, Bishop Collins a bit concerned. And I just said, well, it's done. I didn't, why shouldn't I? Because to my mind, in my head, I found wanting is a part of... Okay, so I was with Alex when I got this job. I wasn't married, and I was thinking, oh, for once, I won't have to say, and by the way, I'm in a lesbian relationship, I hope that's not a problem, or what are you going to do to support me with the risk that I wouldn't get the job? In fact, all that happened was they were concerned that I wasn't married.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you mentioned your partner. Why aren't you married, in effect? Well, because we're not. Oh, okay then. I never thought that would be an issue. I would be aware, because of how things are in this diocese, that, and I did organise, the only other thing I've done was I've had to organise back in September this sort of half day thing at the cathedral to replicate something that had been done in Guildford in the context of the shared conversations. Mm. It's not kind of when I would ever have organised myself, but I was asked to do it, so I had pretty much had to do it. I never would have a morning where people have no opportunity to talk to each other, where you've got three lectures, one on history, one pro-gay Bible, one anti-gay Bible. It's just, no, not the way I do things, but... So, and all of that shared conversation stuff I've just kept totally away from, because I feel like back in 1990 I was heading up an organisation for which the main philosophy was you can only have constructive conversation about sexuality if you start from a position of saying everybody's sexuality is valid and equal. If you don't start there, it's not fair. The power dynamic is not fair and you're not going to get a good conversation. So the shared conversations don't start there. They problematise only one kind of sexuality, and we all know which one that is. and they put the spotlight on gay people, and then they wonder why it's a damaging process. So, you know, there's no way I'm going anywhere near any of that.
Mm. What do you see happening to the Church of England in terms of? To me, it seems there cannot be a middle ground for much longer.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just getting out of time.
It's all right. We'll wrap up in a minute.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that event I've just mentioned is that if that had been 20 years ago, the feeling in the room would not have... I mean, it felt to me like the anti-gay bloke, I'll just use shorthand, was not... I didn't sense anyone in the room was sympathetic to him.
Okay.
And this was just a bunch... It was 70 or 80... middle of the road Anglicans.
What's the age demographic of these people?
55 plus.
Okay, that's interesting.
There were some younger people. There was one youth worker who was saying, why do none of these people listen to young people on this? Where's young people's experience? Yeah. It was written question. She wrote her question, but it wasn't asked, obviously. So I just think, as Linda Woodhead says, people's perceptions have changed, their opinions have changed. They've lived... The church has stopped. It just stopped in about... It stopped change institutionally, didn't it? Mm. In about 1992, three. It's just put its finger... Decided to put its fingers over its ears and go, listening. And then gay marriage comes in and says, oh, shit, what are we going to do now? With the civil partnership kind of question in the middle, where they got a bit confused because at one point that's what they said they wanted, and then when it came in, I said, oh no, we didn't really mean that. And now it's all caught up in what's the definition of marriage, but that's a kind of sideshow, really. that's just the way it's portrayed. So I think at some point the institution will have to catch up with reality.
Okay.
And I don't know how that's going to happen, because it's dug itself into so many holes, like the triple bar on doing gay weddings in church. Obviously this is an Anglican dominated perspective, because that's what I'm most familiar with.
Yeah.
But I'm optimistic in the sense that I do think people have moved on.
Mm.
You can't live in a culture where everything's changed, and therefore you know more people and you're familiar with more people. And you know, and it's the same on the transgender stuff, because that was nowhere really. It was just emerging. I remember publishing one article by a female to male transsexual, as he called himself then, and one article on pastoral questions around a minister who was dealing with someone who was a cross-dresser in our congregation. But it was hardly ever spoken about at that point.
Yeah.
And now, you know, it's like you feel like every other person you meet is transgender.
Well, it's also a staple diet on Channel 4 and Channel 5 every night, you know, my transgender rabbit summer camp. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing for me is the bee's still missing nearly the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, you know, my kind of mission thing, really.
Well, I couldn't believe it when, I can't remember which report it was. It was one of those big, thick ones. It was some issues or some more issues.
The response to some issues. The original some issues.
But it had that line about the only mention of bisexuality was, bisexuality by definition is wrong because it means having a relationship with a man and woman at the same time.
Yes, I know. I wish I had the energy. The kids wouldn't let it happen. And
how could you just not even know? That's not what the word means.
It's also sort out your personality disorder. there's 17 pages on homosexuality in that document and 10 lines, one word on bisexuality.
Then it's that complete obsession which remains, and that's what's behind. The marriage has got to mean one man and one woman. It's about gender polarity. Strict gender binary, which is what I wrote back in 1995 about complementarity. And I think we all concluded that is the rest of society's kind of got on with there being a spectrum of gender and a spectrum of sexuality and change and fluidity and all of that, but that's kind of seems like it's new news.
Yeah.
Even if it's not to real people in real churches, it is to...
Yeah.
I mean, there was a woman at that conference who... and this is where I catch myself. I had two conferences in a week. One was on death, befriending death, and the other one was this one on sexuality. And there was a woman who was on both, and she came on both, and she was the first person to arrive to the sexuality one. And so, I suppose, to stereotype, she's a kind of mumsy-looking older woman, very lovely, obviously with a pastoral care role in our congregation. And she was chatting to the historian, Scott, before anyone else arrived. And then she said to me, well, yeah, because my husband's transgender. And I said, oh my God. And then I thought, why should I be surprised that somebody who looks like her would have a transgender husband? And because she was just saying, you know, this means, you know, that the new legislation means that we don't have to get divorced, we can stay married, because we would have had to got divorced when he transitioned. And you think, yeah.
Wow,
that's just an average Anglican in an average church in the diocese, you know, who comes on my pastoral care courses.
That's awesome. But, yeah.
And we had Rachel Mann to speak at a conference on loneliness, and someone I know who's on one of my committees, lovely woman, background in social worker, newish priest.
Yeah.
And she said to me, she said, oh yeah, I really want to chat with Rachel because my son's transgender. Wow. So it's emerging as common and not a big deal. As 20 years ago, lesbian and gay stuff did.
Yeah.
And that's got to have an impact.
Mm.
At some point, the leadership has to bow to reality, I think.
Before everyone dies off.
Everyone being who? You mean before the church dies off?
the elderly congregations. Well, that's fine. I'll wrap up because I know you've got an appointment. That's fantastic. Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm going to give you any water. I have to try and wade through.